A retired civil servant sits alone in his cramped St. Petersburg apartment, writing furiously to no one in particular. He's 40 years old, financially secure, and utterly miserable. His opening words cut like a scalpel. "I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I am an unattractive man." This is no ordinary confession. This is the voice of a man who has thought himself into paralysis, who has become so conscious of his own consciousness that he can no longer act. Written in 1864, this novella diagnosed a peculiarly modern affliction, the disease of excessive awareness, decades before psychology had the vocabulary to describe it. What happens when your mind becomes so sharp it cuts you from the inside out? Meet someone who embodies every contradiction you've ever felt but were too polite to admit. During his 20 years as a petty bureaucrat, he took perverse pleasure in making citizens wait unnecessarily, demanding pointless paperwork, speaking dismissively, all while knowing his cruelty was petty and meaningless. Now retired, he refuses medical treatment for his liver disease purely out of spite. What makes this character so unsettling is his brutal self-awareness combined with complete inability to change. He recognizes every contradiction, yet persists anyway, finding a shameful sweetness in his own degradation. Think of scrolling through social media at 2 a.m., fully aware you should sleep, yet unable to stop, and somehow deriving satisfaction from this very awareness of your weakness. While normal people act decisively because they see simple cause and effect, he sees infinite chains of causation, paralyzing him with possibilities. Even contemplating revenge becomes more satisfying than its execution, because imagination offers unlimited scenarios that reality can never match. The narrator rebels against mathematics, not disputing that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but finding this certainty unbearable. What do I care for the laws of nature and arithmetic when, for some reason, I dislike those laws? This isn't petulance. It's asserting human dignity against determinism. In the 1860s, thinkers believed human behavior could be scientifically optimized. The narrator savagely attacks this. Throughout history, humans have deliberately acted against rational self-interest, choosing suffering over comfort, chaos over order. The Crystal Palace, that famous London exhibition hall, becomes his symbol for rational utopia, a prison where one cannot even stick out one's tongue in defiance. His most revolutionary claim? The highest human advantage isn't advantage at all. It's free will itself, even when exercised irrationally. Even if scientists discovered a formula perfectly predicting all human desires, we would deliberately violate it, proving we aren't mechanical organ stops. This anticipated existentialism's core principle: choice itself constitutes human dignity, regardless of where that choice leads. Here lies the most disturbing revelation. Humans don't simply endure suffering, we actively seek it. Suffering is the sole origin of consciousness. Without pain, we'd remain in blissful but mindless contentment, never questioning existence. The narrator's life demonstrates this with excruciating precision. When an officer moves him aside without acknowledgement, he obsesses for years, even writing a satirical novel about the man. He walks the same streets, hoping for another encounter, rehearsing confrontations that never materialize. His suffering becomes self-definition. If he cannot be respected, he'll at least be memorably despised. Normal people accept life's limitations and find contentment. He refuses reconciliation with necessity's stone walls, finding perverse pleasure in futile rebellion. His resistance becomes a testament to human freedom, even if that freedom only manifests as choosing suffering. The cruel irony? His superior consciousness isolates him. He sees through social conventions that make life bearable and cannot return to the unexamined life that might allow happiness. Yet he clings to this suffering as proof of his humanity, preferring conscious torment to unconscious contentment. Theory meets reality with devastating results. When former schoolmates organize a farewell dinner for Zverkov, a successful military officer he despises for his superficial charm, he impulsively invites himself, knowing he'll be unwelcome. This self-destructive decision exemplifies his pattern of deliberately seeking situations that confirm his worst fears. The dinner becomes an excruciating study in humiliation. They've changed the time without informing him, leaving him waiting alone. When they arrive, they barely acknowledge him. Zverkov treats him with condescending courtesy while others exchange smirks. Throughout dinner, he oscillates between desperate attempts to assert superiority and painful awareness of his social failure. His literary references fall flat. His sophisticated jokes land nowhere. His rambling toast provokes only contempt. For 3 hours afterward, he paces the hotel corridor while they celebrate inside, unable to leave, yet unable to participate. He imagines elaborate scenarios of revenge and reconciliation, knowing he lacks the social capability to execute either. This scene reveals his fundamental dilemma. Acute self-consciousness makes natural interaction impossible. He overthinks every gesture, transforming social situations into battlegrounds where he inevitably loses. Despite his penetrating critique of social conventions, he remains desperately dependent on others' approval, a contradiction he cannot resolve. After the disastrous dinner, he encounters Liza, a young prostitute with unusual seriousness. He delivers a cruel lecture about her inevitable decline, rapid aging, mounting debt, and death alone in some filthy cellar. Beneath this cruelty lies a genuine desire to save her, mixed with his need to assert intellectual dominance. When his graphic descriptions reduce her to sobbing, he panics and gives her his address. Days later, she visits his squalid apartment, catching him mid-confrontation with his servant. Mortified, he lashes out viciously, confessing he visited her only to avenge an earlier humiliation. Then comes the novel's most profound moment. Instead of responding with anger, Liza embraces him with compassion. She sees through his vicious words to his underlying unhappiness. For a brief moment, genuine human connection seems possible, yet he cannot accept this compassion. His shame at being understood transforms into a desire to dominate her. After a loveless physical encounter, he spitefully thrusts money into her hand, the ultimate insult to her genuine feelings. This episode reveals his core tragedy. Given a genuine opportunity for connection and redemption, he sabotages it. His consciousness has twisted so completely that he cannot recognize love without seeing it as a power struggle. This 1864 voice anticipated existentialism before it formally existed, diagnosing modern alienation and articulating consciousness's paradoxes before psychology had the vocabulary. The insistence on free will, rejection of deterministic systems, and emphasis on irrational choice became foundational existentialist principles decades later. The underground functions as metaphor for modern existence, not just physical isolation, but mental retreat into obsessive self-analysis. It represents both refuge and prison, protecting from social humiliation while trapping in sterile self-examination. The work endures through unflinching psychological realism. Its stream of consciousness narrative, with digressions, contradictions, and direct reader addresses, revolutionized literary form. Its willingness to expose concealed thoughts opened new possibilities for exploring consciousness, echoing through Kafka's isolated protagonists, existentialist antiheroes, and contemporary autofiction. Most importantly, it voiced a condition increasingly relevant: alienation in a rationalized, bureaucratic world. The desperate assertion of individuality against systems reducing us to predictable formulas resonates powerfully in our algorithmic age. When AI claims to understand our desires better than we do, the underground man's rebellion against the Crystal Palace feels less like historical curiosity and more like prophecy. Consciousness remains both curse and blessing, source of suffering and dignity. We cannot think our way out of being human, cannot rationalize away contradictions, cannot optimize ourselves into happiness. The underground man's legacy endures because he articulates this problem with brutal honesty. The most human thing is refusing to be reasonable and insisting on our right to choose suffering over someone else's idea of happiness.